Haven Barlow was an insurance agent, and he ran a bill through the state legislature that exempted people from some continuing education if you had been licensed since a certain date. And the date he picked was the day after he got his insurance license. I mean, so he grandfathered himself by one day. It was a license as of April 23rd of such and such a year. She says, "I know Haven," and that doesn't surprise me. But at any rate, when it comes to all of these stamps at these events, I just let them pass by anymore. I still do my continuing education for my certified financial planner designation. So it's not that I've abandoned CE. I still get as much as I ever have, but I just don't have to report it to the state of Utah. Well, for that matter, I was exempted from CE by virtue of the CFP. Anyway, so.
So did he teach ethics as well?
Yeah, Haven? Yeah. Yeah, he did. I want to have this be more of a discussion than a lecture. I'm not confident I've got enough material here to stretch for an hour. Unless we can start telling stories and help one another to learn. I want to take a real quick look and see. I'm supposed to go until 3 o'clock. Okay, welcome. When we're dealing with ethics, we've got four areas of responsibility if we're in the financial services arena. The first area of responsibility we have is to the companies that we represent. I know a lot of you feel like you represent your clients. That's the main thing you're there to be, as an advocate for your clients. Have you read your contracts? Because that's not the way they read. Your first area of responsibility is to your company. And if you get a complaint about your business or your business practices or something that somebody's upset with, you're not supposed to handle it yourself. The first thing you're required to do is report it to your company. Isn't that correct? Yeah. Let them handle the ball. You're to turn things over to them. Your first area of responsibility is to the company that you represent, to represent them accurately and fairly, and follow their policies and their procedures. The second person that you would owe a debt of ethical behavior to would be to yourself and to your fellow practitioners. We heard a heartbreaking story yesterday morning, didn't we? That courageous woman talking about the problems that occurred when her husband, the sociopath, started a Ponzi scheme that ran 20 years. The question I thought of last night as I was laying there in bed, I would have liked to have asked her, is what triggered him to finally go in and report himself? Yeah, maybe he was just reaching the end of the process, where you can only pay off so many investors with the money that you're bringing in from the later investors, and maybe he was just at the end of his rope and he couldn't spin that lie out any longer. I don't know. But the pain that he caused with his family, the pain that he caused with those who placed their trust in him and gave him their life savings, the damage ripples through the whole community and paints all of us with a little bit of that same brush, doesn't it? So you have a responsibility to perform ethically for your fellow practitioners' good. The third group that you would owe a debt of ethical behavior to would be to your clients. Those individuals who, because of the relationship you're able to establish with them, trust you to help them with their decision-making process to properly prepare for themselves, for their families, and for their future. And that's a... I'll talk a little bit later on about the Society of Financial Service Professionals' professional pledge. But I got my CLU and CHFC in 1985. And I ordered a walnut plaque with the professional pledge engraved, laser engraved in the walnut plaque. And I have it at in my office right by the door where I go out, so that I see it every day to remind me to make sure that I treat my clients as I would treat myself if I were in their situation, and I'll make every effort to understand what their situation is. And then the last group of individuals that you owe an ethical responsibility to would be the public at large. Even those individuals that you don't contact personally as your clients, just the public at large, you owe a debt to them to behave ethically so that you don't give our whole industry a black eye and create misgivings in their minds that would prevent them from seeking out the advice and help that they might need. Some of the major ethical issues that face us in the financial services industry would first of all be a failure to properly identify the customer's needs. Because needs are not identified, inappropriate products can be sold. That can be due to a lack of knowledge on our part. It's impossible for us to be an expert in all areas of insurance and investing. If you've got a strong life insurance practice, but you're not really up to speed in the area of disability income, perhaps you ought to know somebody like Bart Spencer, who is the DI nut, as it says right there on his shirt, the DI nut. He knows the ins and outs of disability income as well as anybody in the business. If you don't understand long-term care insurance, perhaps you'd better partner up with somebody who has expertise in that area. If you don't understand the investment world, maybe you'd better form some relationships in those areas. It's criminal behavior, unethical behavior, to hold yourself out as an expert in everything that there is to know about financial planning arena. Become self-aware of where your weaknesses are. Another area where we get into trouble is the failure to identify who we are and what we do. It can manifest itself by hiding behind titles or labels instead of stating that you're an insurance agent or a registered representative. I saw one guy's business card said he was an estate planologist. What do you really do? I sell life insurance, but I help people organize their estates. I'm an estate planologist. Brad.
We're old enough, maybe half the room doesn't remember. Do you remember the movie The Four Seasons?
Yeah.
With Alan Alda.
Alan Alda.
Yeah, one of the characters in the remember was an insurance guy. I think he worked for Equitable, I can't remember. And he says, he was asked what he did, and he says, well, I'm an estate planner. And his wife goes, who are you kidding? You're a member of the Million Dollar Roundtable. You don't remember that?
Yeah. Failure to identify who you are and what you do. You might falsely claim to be an advisor or a consultant instead of a salesperson. I actually am a licensed insurance consultant, and I was the first person in my company to form my own registered investment advisor. I've since closed it up, and now that they've expanded what they do, I've closed it up and rolled into my company's. I'm an associated person of their registered investment advisor. I can call myself an advisor. I can charge fees for the advice that I give. But there's a lot of folks out there who are agents and registered representatives who are holding themselves out to be financial planners or financial advisors or whatever, instead of identifying who you really are. Bart.
I heard Van Miller say today he is proud to tell people he's an insurance agent.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
He doesn't hide behind anything
else. Exactly right. But what does Van Miller know?
I was just going to say, with most companies' compliance, they say you can't call yourself a financial planner if you're not a certified financial planner. You can't call yourself a financial consultant if you're not a chartered financial consultant. So there was one lady, when we were a principal, that said, well, I get around all that by just calling myself a financial goddess.
Did you guys hear that? He talked about in this area of compliance that many companies, you can't call yourself a financial planner unless you are a certified financial planner. You can't call yourself a consultant unless you're a chartered financial consultant. But back in the day when we were working together at Principal Financial Group, there was a woman there who said, I'd get around all that by just calling myself a financial goddess. Yeah. There's a lot of us that meet the compliance needs on our business cards and our stationery or letterhead, but in our conversation, we play fast and loose with this business of being an advisor versus being an agent or a registered representative. Another area where we get into trouble is the failure to act objectively. It's the ability to balance your personal gain against the proper performance of one's duties. And when we have a commission-based compensation element in our practice, this is an issue that we face every day. I have oftentimes explained to my clients the way I hope I handle this. I explain the circumstances of when my mother was having some heart problems. And she went into the McCady Hospital in Ogden and went in to see a cardiologist. And the cardiologist represented the plan of action to be to go in through the vein in the leg and to use a stent and open up the vein that was closing off by using a stent. Now, what I don't want to have happen is the cardiologist thinking, you know, this woman could probably be well served with a stent, but a bypass surgery isn't a bad idea either. You know, then we know we've got it solved with a bypass. And I did promise my wife that trip to the south of France. And if I do a stent, it's a $8,000 procedure, and if I do an open heart, it's a $25,000 procedure. And so why don't we just go with the open heart? Now, I really don't want him doing that if it's my mom that's involved. I don't want the extra risk from the open heart. On the other hand, I do not want him saying to himself, this woman probably needs open heart surgery. We probably ought to do a bypass. But you know, she's not in here wearing a mink coat. It's a cloth coat. They don't look like they have all the money in the world. Maybe a stent will be good enough, and it would sure save them a lot of money. Let's try a stent and hope it works. Now, do we want that kind of thinking going on? We want the doctor to make the recommendation based on as if it was his own mother that was going to be there. Oh, there's a third choice. We don't do anything. We just write a prescription for these various lipid drugs that reduce the cholesterol, and then ask for modification in diet and exercise, and we can just take care of it with an office visit and writing a prescription. You know, so there's very little cost, a moderate cost or a major cost. So does a doctor face these ethical concerns, this balance of compensation versus services that are rendered? What about an attorney? I took a client in to see Tom one time. He and I had gone through the chairs together at the Salt Lake Estate Planning Council. He was one chair behind me as we went through to the, you know, vice president and president of the Salt Lake Estate Planning Council. And I had thought that they needed a will and possibly a revocable living trust and some powers of attorney and, you know, nice little comprehensive estate plan. And talking with him and found out their circumstances, and he said, you know, with what you want to have accomplished, the way the intestacy laws in the state of Utah are written, the money will flow to where you want it to go. And the cost of opening an informal probate are the same or less than a full estate plan. And you don't have to pay the money now. You can wait many years in the future before you have to do the probate. Why don't we just do a general durable power of attorney in case you get disabled so that people can manage your financial affairs? So, you know, $100, a couple hundred bucks for powers of attorney instead of $1,500 or $2,000 for a full estate plan. Tom Christensen, I thought that was terrific. You know, that's what you want to see. Is an attorney's compensation colored by what recommendations he makes? Even down to a CPA, how they complete your tax return and how many schedules they include in your tax return. And they can color their compensation by what they do and how they serve you. So the fact that we're in a commission-based business should not be a barrier to making appropriate decisions and recommendations to our clients. Anybody have anything you want to add on that? Greg?
I've been to a medical group managers association meeting where one of the classes that was taught was how to, and it was basically how to bill for 10 codes within 5 minutes. Seriously. And that's
the same kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. I can tell you how many times I've had people walk into my office and say, well, we just inherited, you know, $85,000 and we want you to help us invest it. And I start asking them some questions about their circumstances and how much do you owe in credit card bills and how much do you owe here and how much do you owe there and what do you owe on your house. And I end up sending them away, having them paying off their Visa and their MasterCard, paying off their car loan and starting saving money towards buying the next car for cash. And then putting the balance of the money into their mortgage on their house so that their house can be paid off in 8 more years instead of having another 18 years of paying on the mortgage. You know, getting them a guaranteed 6% return, or, you know, minimum mortgages were 6%. I can't guarantee them that in the markets. And then telling them in 8 years when your home's paid for, come and see me again, and then take that, what was your house payment, and invest that with me. You know, I'm big on getting people out of debt. I can't tell you how many times I've sent people away telling them to pay down debt instead of making investments with me. Wish I'd get the banks to pay me a commission. And we get into the philosophy of ethics. We get down to this issue of the self versus others. If we're inwardly focused and only concerned about self, we're going to run into some ethical quandaries. If we're interested in the good of everyone, then we got a better chance decisions can be based on the individual's welfare or on the common good. There's intuition versus rationalism. There are some people who believe that people intuitively know what is good. They believe that there's an inner guide that can tell us what's the correct thing to do. Other people think we need to use reason or rationalism to decide what's good. I'm here to tell you, in my belief, if you feel something is wrong, it probably is. Don't do it. If you find yourself questioning your recommendations, listen to that. Of course, you also have to abide by the insurance and securities rules or codes of conduct that you have from your professional associations. Those are pretty clear cut. Your company's rules, the insurance department's rules, the securities and exchange rules. Now that rotten Department of Labor. Boy, does that one frost my cookies. I'm really unhappy with that one, yes. Sounds a whole lot like a rebate.
But her intention is like trying to help them. She doesn't want to get the money from the niece and nephew. So that's why I say after 3 years, I will just or purchase another insurance for you guys. But they are always the owner. It's not my friend. It's like the person, the niece and nephew.
That kind of sounds like a rebate. If she wants to make a gift to a niece and nephew, buy a policy for them and pay the premium. Yeah, I think you could do that. Greg?
But it also sounds like an inducement, which could be just as bad. If you buy this, then I'll buy this.
No, yeah, if that's what I say. If she wants, with no strings attached, to buy a life insurance policy on a niece or a nephew and pay the premium out of her own pocket as a gift, as a benefit to a family member, I think that would be okay. But if you'll do this, then I'll do this, that becomes a real ethical problem.
What about the age of the children? Are they going to be owners on the policy? And if so, and they, an underage child can't own a policy.
Well, you'd have the, if it were the case I'm referring to that I think would be okay, you would have the parent of the child be the owner of the policy, or at least a temporary ownership until the child reaches the age of majority.
You wouldn't want her to be the beneficiary, of course.
No, she would not be the beneficiary either. That would be an issue. That would be an issue. But if the children name their own beneficiaries, their parents or their siblings, and the parents own the policy, and she simply makes a gift of the premium to them, I think that would be okay. I think you'd run into difficulty, however, if you started doing that for people who are not family members. There was a program around here about 10 or 15 years ago where individuals had 115 or 120% general agents contracts, and they were going around soliciting charitable life insurance policies. We will pay the premium for you to buy this policy and name such and such university as the beneficiary, and we'll pay the premium. Well, they paid the 100% of the premium, and they got 120% commission as a general agent. And that blew up after about 18 months as renewal premiums started to come in and they weren't being paid, and those individuals went to jail. So paying the premium for someone who isn't a family member would be a really questionable behavior, very questionable behavior. Thank you for bringing that up, and thank you for your input, people. There's also absolutism versus relativism. Absolutism. Some people believe that certain things are always good or always right, or certain things are always wrong. Other people believe that it depends on the circumstances. And I would tell you that either mindset can get you into trouble. Relativism can take you down a very slippery slope. But absolutism is another area where you can get into trouble. Very early in my career, I took an LUTC class. Anybody even know what those are anymore? I took an LUTC class with a gentleman who proudly announced that he never sold anything but whole life policies. He said, "Have you ever known anybody to receive a death benefit from a term life insurance policy? The term life insurance only pays off in less than 10% of the term life insurance policies taken out ever pay a death benefit, because the people outlive the term of the policy or they convert it. So there is less than 10% of term life insurance policies ever pay a death benefit. And with a whole life policy or permanent policy, he knows that death is inevitable. Mortality rate is nearly 100%. And so that he knew that the people would eventually receive the benefit from the permanent policy. So under no circumstances would he ever sell anything but a whole life policy. What's wrong with that? They can't buy enough permanent insurance to be able to provide the protection that they need to pay off the house, pay off the car payment, pay off the visa bill, set the college money aside, supplement the Social Security, provide the education fund for the kids, provide education perhaps for the surviving spouse to be able to enter the job force later on. You simply can't buy enough life insurance. What's the best life insurance policy for a person to own? The one they've got, yeah. It would be the one that's enforced when they die. It would be the amount of insurance that would be enough to cover the needs that they have at that point in time at the premium that they can afford. And that's the best life insurance policy. Sometimes that's term, sometimes that's permanent, sometimes that's a mix of term and permanent. So this belief that some things are always right and some things are always wrong versus everything is always relative, either one can get you into trouble. We are obligated to follow the laws and the rules. Those are absolute. But in individual client dealings, different circumstances may call for different recommendations or different solutions. Another area where we can get into trouble is to provide the same type of plan to everybody that you do business with. Perhaps the plan that you have for yourself. You know, well, it's what I'm doing for me. It must be right. It must be the best. And the failure to accommodate somebody else's different circumstances, needs, value systems, desires. Everybody you deal with should probably have a little bit of a different approach in terms of coming up with solutions to their circumstances. when we get to the philosophy of ethics, another one is religious teachings versus individual authority. Most religions have a standard of behavior that spells out right and wrong. Some thinkers believe that each one of us should create our own values. And though religions may vary as to practices and beliefs, as do individuals, at the core of every religion is the golden rule, which is do unto others as you would have done unto you. Again, earlier in my career, when we were getting involved in the very beginnings of the financial planning business, when we weren't simply going out pitching a particular life insurance policy, we were actually generating information and doing a financial plan that took into account dying too soon, living too long, becoming disabled, and coming up with a plan that involved not only insurances but investments and retirement plans. Back when financial planning was just getting started, one of the developers of a particular software system did some training for us, and he talked to me about the platinum rule. He said, the golden rule is how most people believe you should act. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If that isn't good enough for financial planning, in financial planning we apply the platinum rule. Do unto others as they would have you do unto them. You get the difference. The penalties for unethical behavior are pretty severe. Not every breach of ethics is discovered. But the cost, when it's detected, more than outweighs any potential gain. We had one bright young man in our agency that was doing very well, and then he started to do really well. And then we found out that he was selling health insurance without sending in the health insurance application, but applying that premium towards life insurance policies that people didn't know they were getting. And he was selling them life insurance policies with the understanding that they were variable investment products when they were fixed products. And he was generating statements for these life insurance products in these various equity accounts and showing the values going forward.
How long did that last?
About 6 months. And then the agency went to the Attorney General's office and the Insurance Commissioner's office with a stack of files that big. And his beautiful new home and his two brand new beautiful cars and his career were up in smoke. So when an ethical breach is discovered, the pain outweighs any of the potential gains. Ethical breaches end careers more quickly and more completely than any other lapses in business judgment. You can make mistakes. You can make honest mistakes and be okay. You can recover from those. But ethical breaches are irrecoverable. Even if you don't lose your career, you're going to be tarnished. You'll be known as somebody who's more interested in personal gain than in the interests of others. That will follow you around for the rest of your life. You may not realize your behavior has been detected, but your career will go nowhere. Referrals get rare and sales plateau. Good ethics is just plain good business. It can bring you financial gain and personal growth. Your clients will recognize that you are a financial professional and you're acting in their best interests. Your actions can gain the respect of the company or companies that you represent. I got to the end of 1 year, and it was a qualification of $1 million roundtable or not if I had a particular policy issued. And the policy was held up in underwriting. And I called the underwriter to see if there was any way we could get that thing issued before December 31st so that I could get that one last sale to put me over the top to get MDRT. And in the discussion with the underwriter, he indicated his concerns. And I told him that I was unaware of any issues or problems in that area. And the underwriter said, you know, you've been sending in applications for years, and your applications are more complete than most of them that we ever see. And you send in supplemental letters with additional information, and you've always been way up out in front and given us more than the information that we require. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go ahead and just approve this thing based on the reputation you've had with us over the years. Wow. Wasn't that a great benefit? So the reputation you can establish with your company or the companies you represent, your reputation with your peers, the reputation with your clients, you're going to benefit your society as a whole. Your reputation will grow. People in your community will want to do business with you. So there's strong benefits of ethical behavior. Give you another example where I had to wrestle with one for a little while. I had a client that had around $430,000 in an IRA that was in one particular family of mutual funds. It was a good family of mutual funds. And it was performing pretty well for him. But he wanted me more personally involved in the selection of the investments than just turning it over to the management group and having the various mutual fund managers make the decisions. He wanted me more involved in the deal. So I explained to him that we could sign a contract where I would be in a fee-based position where I'd be charging 1.25%, and I'd be selecting from among around 8,000 different mutual funds that were no load or load waived, and I would watch for performance, consistent performance, above average performance, below average risk. I'd screen for that, and then I'd also take a look at trying to keep the fund expenses as low as I possibly could to try to keep his fees and costs down. And he said that sounded good. So I did my screening. I came up with 13 or 14 different funds that I recommended we put together in this particular blend or mix. And he said it looked good. He signed off on it, sent me on my way to transfer this $400,000 account from a commission-based family mutual funds into this managed money platform. A year went by, and it was time to do the annual review. And we brought up the statements and took a look at where we were. And I'm reviewing it at home the night before. I'm going to go see him in the morning. He was disabled, so he didn't come into my office. I went to see him. He was disabled. I'm reviewing it the night before, and I have this sneaking feeling that something's wrong. I'm looking at these funds, still involved in the family of mutual funds, and didn't we think we were going to move to the managed money account? And I went deeper into the file, and I found the paperwork that authorized it, but I never followed through and made the transfers. So in the morning, I made three calls. The first call was to my broker-dealer. The second call was to my compliance department, and the third call was to him. And I told him that we'd be doing some research and we'd get back to him in a few weeks. We would take a look at what it would have been if we had made the changes, including all the distributions, the monthly distributions he'd taken. If we had made the changes or if we had left it alone, in whichever way was in his best interests, we would do that for him. And it took about 3 weeks to get all the information from all the mutual fund companies as to the performance of the funds given the withdrawals that were taking place. Now, when I looked at his mutual fund account, just in the one family of funds, he had a really good return. He had a 14% return for the year. I could have gone out, had the meeting, shown him a 14% growth in the account. He would never have known the difference. I could have made the changes later, and he would never know. But I would always know. So my first three calls, compliance, broker-dealer, the compliance department, and then to the client. It turns out he would have been $14,700 to the good. So my ability to perform as an investment advisor was proven out. We got a higher return for him. Even with the management fee tacked on, we got a higher return for him. I paid a $500 deductible to my errors and omissions insurance, and they wrote him out a check for $14,800 that went into his IRA. That was the best $500 I've ever spent. So, Mike.
So we, so your E&O carrier paid that. You know, the broker dealer didn't take any responsibility for it at all.
Nope. Didn't have to. And I thought that the broker dealer would be freaked out. I thought the compliance people would be, you know, all over me. And they said, you're taking this way too seriously, Ken. This is no big deal. This kind of thing happens. It's errors and omissions insurance. You, in the errors and omissions insurance company, that was no big deal for them. I didn't get into trouble on any level with any of the organizations, and my client thought I was a hero. Well, I disclosed that morning what had happened, that I had failed to make the transfer. And when we determined that that the advice was in his best interests, and we gave him the extra money, and then we made the transfers and, you know, made the set it up the way it was supposed to be, he was one happy camper. And none of the people that I was worried about had any real heartburn over it. They told me I was taking it way too seriously.
Kind of same thing happened to me. I was filling out a mutual fund application with a lady who wanted in fixed account, I mean a money market account. I put it in a floating rate. It was the, I marked the box.
One below.
I had to do the same exact thing. And it, if you're ethical, it burnt me up to do it. It cost me. I had to take go through my errors and omissions. But I still got a good.
There you go. Another endorsement from Boyd.
It scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
How much did your insurance go up?
Didn't. My E&O insurance didn't go up at all. No problem.
Did they have to file a complaint in order for E&O to pay?
No. No, it was self-reported on my part. There never was a complaint from the client. Yeah. Boyd's seeing the same thing in his instance, where he checked the box below by mistake instead of the box for the investment she wanted. So, no, it was...
It was filled out in front of her, too. She signed right below me.
There,
I just wondered, on those kind of policies, do they have a copay you pay?
No, a deductible. In my case, Scott, it was simply a deductible. No copay involved at all. We have 5 minutes. There was an organization called IMSA, the Insurance Marketplace Standards Association, and it's now the Compliance and Ethics Forum for Life Insurers. Well, back when it was Insurance Marketplace Standards, there was a Principles of Ethical Conduct that they published for their member companies, and the company I represent or have represented for 40 years was a member of IMSA. It's number one, to conduct business according to high standards of honesty and fairness and to render that service to its customers, which in the same circumstances would apply to or demand for itself. Number two, to provide competent and customer-focused sales and service. Three, to engage in active and fair competition. 4, to provide advertising and sales materials that are clear as to purpose and honest and fair as to content. 5, to provide for fair and expeditious handling of customer complaints. 6, to maintain a system of supervision and review that's reasonably designed to achieve compliance with these principles of ethical conduct. There's the NAFA Code of Ethics. I've been a member of NAFA as long as I've been a member, as long as I've had a contract in the insurance industry. Well, there was about 3 or 4 months that went by before I joined NAFA, but virtually from the same time. The preamble of the NAFA Code of Ethics says, helping my clients protect their assets and establish financial security, independence, and economic freedom for themselves and those they care about is a noble endeavor and deserves my promise to support high standards of integrity, trust, and professionalism throughout my career as an insurance and financial professional. With these principles as a foundation, I freely accept the following obligations: to help maintain my clients' confidences and protect their right to privacy, to work diligently to satisfy the needs of my clients, to present accurately and honestly all facts essential to my clients' financial decisions, to render timely and proper service to my clients and ultimately their beneficiaries, to continually enhance my professionalism by developing my skills and increasing my knowledge through education, to obey the letter and spirit of all laws and regulations which govern my profession, conduct all business dealings in a manner which would reflect favorably on NAFA and my profession, to cooperate with others whose services best promote the interests of my clients, and to protect the financial interests of my clients, their financial products, and my profession through political advocacy. And I want to finish with the professional pledge. For a number of years, after I had been the president of the Utah chapter of the Society of Financial Service Professionals, I was the liaison between the National Association and the local chapter. And as such, I had the responsibility and privilege of inducting each year's group of officers to the Utah chapter. And in each instance, I led everybody in the officers and directors and everybody in the room in the professional pledge. I'll give it to you in the way it is written here, and then I'll just kind of put it in English. In all my professional relationships, I pledge myself to the following rule of ethical conduct. I shall, in the light of all conditions surrounding those I serve, which I shall make every conscientious effort to ascertain and understand, render that service in which, in the same circumstances, I would apply to myself. What that means to you, Mr. or Mrs. Client, is that I will never make a recommendation to you that I wouldn't be willing to take if I were in your situation, and I'll do everything I can to fully understand and appreciate your situation. Does anybody have any final comments or questions? Thank you for your time.